This week's podcast is brought to you by Alluring Africa, which is a Florida-based boutique African tour operator founded by my friend Sunit Sangrachka. Sunit was born and raised in Africa, growing up in a family that started one of the first photographic companies in Kenya. Sunit and his team specialize in conservation-based safaris to Africa's exclusive wilderness areas that support its wildlife and communities. Alluring Africa goes beyond the prepackaged itineraries you see online because they understand the only way to organize the best experience for you is to have an intimate understanding of what you care about. Give them a call on 800-510-6059 or go to their website www.alluringafrica.com, and that's spelled A-L-L-U-R-I-N-G-A-F-R-I-C-A. Thanks for tuning in to the Greenpeace, that's spelt P-I-E-C-E. I'm Warren Green, your host and one of the storytellers of this weekly podcast, where I'll be telling campfire stories about sustainable safaris, misadventures, and travel tales from around the world. I have a number of interesting people, including safari guides, conservationists, lodge managers, and philanthropists, lined up to share their stories and expertise with you. So, grab yourself a beverage, sink back into a comfortable chair, and enjoy the next half an hour with me. Matthew Jordan, sitting over in Idaho this morning, I believe.
Yes, I'm in Idaho today. Idaho, well, I'm in Boise, which is the city of trees, which is a very nice place.
I've only been to Boise once before, and that literally was to get off an airplane and then hop into a car and drive across that long extended valley on my way into Sun Valley. And I have a memory of that drive because it was late in the afternoon. The sun was setting behind the mountains behind me as I drove towards Sun Valley. And in front, the mountain range glowed this sort of beautiful shade of pink and with a hint of orange in the sky. And then the tops of the mountains were painted in white snow. It was absolutely extraordinary. Is this the sort of view that you have on a daily basis in the winter?
Yeah, in a kind of an ironic twist, the front of my house where I'm staying now looks over this a very nice green suburb with a very beautiful view of the mountains on the third floor. And the back of my house actually looks over an industrial park. So you get both worlds. I like that, you know. I like the mix.
Industrial park. What is Idaho producing that's industrial?
It's like a series of small businesses that are it's like a bunch of warehouses. And yeah, so you get both worlds, you know. You get the nature and the whatever that is on the back of my house.
Yeah. I guess you look out the one window and get inspired to leave the other door.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
Matt, so you left that other door and ventured over to Africa and got yourself involved in Gorongosa. How did that come to pass? I mean, Gorongosa is miles away in the middle of a sort of a forgotten African country called Mozambique. What drew you there?
Thanks for asking that question. It's such a privilege. I have to say it's such a privilege to be able to have this conversation with you. And we've chatted before and you've chatted with some of my colleagues. So it just is really exciting to be able to tell this story because I think, you know, it was definitely my story. I felt that I was on a journey. And then once I got involved with Gorongosa, I definitely became involved in something a bit greater than myself. And that's what's kind of exciting. And my story really begins about 9 years ago, so it's almost a decade now, when I had finished up some work, finished up some traveling, and I was excited to do this next thing, which was join the Peace Corps. So like so many before me and so many while I was serving, I had a call to service, which is I wanted to do something abroad. I had traveled a bit, and I wanted to give back, essentially, for, you know, so much that had been freely given to me. And And so I signed up. I did this interview, and it was a long process. And then one day, I'm sitting in my aunt's kitchen, and I get a letter, and the letter says, "You are going to Mozambique." The first thing I did was ask the question, "What is Mozambique?" And then I looked it up on a map, you know, and I was like, "Oh, okay, it's in Africa. It's in Southern Africa. It's on the Indian Ocean. It has, you know, thousands of miles of coastline. It's a beautiful place." And what I in the interview process, I think, was maybe one of the funniest things, where I said, they said, "Okay, so tell us some things that you just don't want." And I said, "Well, I don't want to go to Africa, and I don't want to be a teacher." And they took notes. And said, "Okay, great." And in my letter, it says "You're going to Mozambique, and you're going to be a teacher." And that's where I think I come to this same point over and over in my life, where I think I want something, and then, you know, opportunities present themselves in a very different way. And if I just lean into those things, often I get more reward than I ever would have gotten if I would have kept things constrained to my own desire. So, you know, long story short, I ended up going over there, serving in a rural village in Niassa for 2.5 years. It was what many would consider a stereotypical Peace Corps conversation, super isolated. You know, all you do is sit around and watch the corn grow. You gossip, you go to the market and haggle for, you know, 2 or 3 cents off of like 4 tomatoes. You know, that was like the entertainment for the day. No power, no running water. And that really was an immersive experience where I, you know, as much as a human being can learn in 2 years about, you know, a small subset of a very diverse culture, I learned a lot about the Dao people that live in that kind of, it's a very small area they live in between this kind of Sangha mountain and then Cabo Delgado to the east. So it's a very small tribe that lives in that specific area.
Just for people who are unfamiliar with the geography of Mozambique, Niassa is way up in the north, sort of northwest side of the country. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. It's a massive province, and it has just a handful of people in it. Yeah. So
to get there, you've got to fly up to Pemba, and then you either get in a car or drive across. How did you actually get up there to start your stay?
Yeah, they have Lishinga is the capital of the province. So yeah, Niassa borders the Tanzania on the north, and then it borders Lake Malawi on the west side. So right in the middle, there's the provincial capital called Lishinga, and you fly and you land in Lishinga, and it's surprisingly cold for, you know, most parts of Mozambique are not cold. So you get a chill factor, which is kind of interesting. And then you jump in a car and you drive hours. Like, you feel that you've come to the end of the earth, and then you drive hours away from there, you know, and then you start to think that was civilization. And, you know, in my life, in my travels, I got to visit Tibet and see Lhasa, which is the capital of Tibet. And when you go to, it felt like that. I'm not trying to be like dramatic, you know, but it really is this end of the world experience. And then once you get there, then you drive for like 6 hours, or it's somewhere between 4 to 6 hours, depending on the road, to the little village called Makaloj, where I was living.
Say the name of that village again.
Yeah, Makaloj. And then in kind of a pun, we would say Makalonji, which is super long away from every human being. So, right. So I started my journey there in Mozambique. I lived there 2.5 years. I read tons of books. I think I really gave a lot of effort for the small school I was involved in. And I was involved at some things at the national level, including a big science fair, which was kind of exciting, and some other things. And then my service ended. It took about 2.5 years. And I was, you know, I cannot emphasize how done with living in Mozambique I was. I was completely done. I was racing to get on a plane and get out of the country. I told myself I probably will not come back. It was so hard. You know, if you've ever, you've ever lived, you know, as a rural Mozambican, you know, the conditions that they face on a daily basis are incredibly trying. Just no power, no water, you know, incredibly difficult, just basic conditions that you have to face on a daily basis. And I don't pretend to be very, you know, a super strong and hardcore guy. So I was pretty tired. And then I started to throw my resume around. And somebody, yeah, please.
Yeah. Just before you go into that, I really want people to appreciate the adventurer in you, because going to that village, driving along a dusty African road, needs some perspective. Because yeah. I think from the Western world's point of view, we step out of our front door, we hit a tarmac at its surface, and we complain if there's a pothole that hasn't been addressed by the local Department of Transportation. Try and, if you can, just to describe the journey from the airport into the village.
I can tell you a very short anecdote about a very typical journey back to my house after a day of going to the big city and trying to buy some, you know, some eggs, whatever. So, and this is the journey that so many Mozambicans take on a daily basis. And I found it quite fascinating. So I would get, this was in the rainy season. And if you've ever been to this part of Africa during the rainy season, the world changes, everything gets green, and all the roads just turn to this soup. It's like, it's incredible that, you know, how impossible they are to travel on. And so we get in a local minibus, and you have to wait at the market for like 3 or 4 hours till the minibus pulls up, you know. And then as it fills up, this funny thing happens where all the seats are taken, but then they keep putting people inside of the minibus. And then once more people than you can imagine are filled the minibus, then they start putting things like chickens and goats and other stuff all over, you know, on your lap or wherever they might think about. So then we then you start your journey, and I can tell you it is crowded in that little bus, and you're going, and it is, you know, there's no shocks to speak of. It's just basically a hammer. It's like riding on a hammer. And then, you know, because it's raining, this funny thing happens with all of the inclines that they become impossible to go up with this minibus. So then everyone has to pile out, and in a kind of genius move by the driver, he forces everyone to push the minibus up the hills and get muddy. And as you're pushing, you're covered in mud, it's raining on you, you ask yourself, I'm paying for this. I paid this driver to push his minibus up this hill. And so it's a very funny experience. And then you go and you go for about, on my worst day, it was like 6 hours. And you leave tarmac, then you leave, you know, a graded road, and then you're just going in this, you know, this very bush rural road until you, you know, and you see kind of small villages along the way, and the villages themselves are they've basically been crafted from just mud and small sticks and poles that are chopped from the local hardwood trees that are there and rocks, and they'll make these mud huts with grass roofing. And often what'll happen is the huts will get rained out. So they'll craft them up, and then they have a pretty short life cycle, and then they'll get washed right back into the mud, then they'll craft them up again. And it does create a bit of resiliency in terms of surviving the extreme weather events. On the flip side, it's not a very comfortable dwelling, and it can be a bit of a challenge, I think, there's no lights, no water, things like that. So you pass those villages along the way, then you show up in this district town. So it's a district town, which is Makaloj, and there's these these funny Portuguese trees. I can't remember the name of them off the top of my head. They're yellow and they have this spiral bark and they yellow flowers. And you come in there, there's a few of them lining this road. And then everyone's there to meet you. Then you get some kids to help carry your stuff. And then you walk.
You just survived the journey.
Yeah, you've survived the journey. You know, you've survived it. And you've basically complained. Meanwhile, there's a lot of old ladies who don't complain. So you have to. It's very humbling to be in those situations. It's okay to complain, but there is an amount of humility, I think, that comes when you see. And this has happened to me over and over my years in Mozambique, where one time I ran a local race and these old ladies passed me, you know, no shoes, you know, and they just kind of look at you and they definitely don't insult you, you know, but they just kind of crush your spirit. And that sort of happens over and over, you know, where you just realize you're soft, you know, your hands are made for computer work and they, and your butt is made for, sitting on soft pillowed things. And so, that was my lesson in Mozambique. Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for sharing that perspective, because I think it's really, really important, because it just goes to show that going into Mozambique to participate in any kind of project, particularly from a Western perspective, is not something one does lightly. It is an endurance. It's a hardship. Yeah. It really throws into perspective the simplicity of our life over here in America, but it's not simple. It's the comfortability of our life in America, where you turn on a tap, you've got water, you turn on another tap or outlet or faucet, you've got hot boiling water,
yeah.
You open the refrigerator door and you've got a neat tray of ice blocks waiting to drop into your gin and tonic in the evening.
Yeah, yeah.
And we do take a whole lot for granted. And so, yeah, I'm full of admiration for people like yourself who head over to that beautiful continent and seriously dive in head first, hands first, and muck in. So then you leave your village, I'm sure, very anxious to come home and get something cold and refreshing out of the refrigerator, make a sandwich with deli meats and so on. And then you end up back there, or not so immediately.
immediately. That was the craziest thing. I remember the day that I was going to get out of there, and I remember just being like, I'm done. You know, this was too hard. And I think this is really why Gorongosa might be a very special thing for me. You know, I think it was calling somebody who was looking for a calling. And so that's my story. And my resume got in the hands of Greg Carr, and he invited me to do an interview. So I'd been home just for a few weeks. I had a couple other interviews. In my past life, I was an engineer, you know, not an incredible engineer, but I was a pretty qualified engineer. I have a graduate degree, and I've worked professionally. And it was my career, you know, if one has careers, that was my career. So I had some pretty great offers from these things. And then I decided I would give it a shot just because why not? You know, why? I have a very open door policy in my life where I sort of leave things open and then assess when you have a lot of opportunities. Better to assess 20 opportunities than limit yourself to 5. So,
When I was first introduced to you, one of the adjectives I wouldn't have thought to use to describe you is masochist.
right.
You know, you've just had 2 years of good reasons not to return to Mozambique, and yet this becomes your calling. I just find that somewhat humorous.
Yeah, and I think that's the funniest thing about maybe my personality is that I'm not particularly hardcore, nor do I particularly love the grind. You know, I think I have a passion that allows me to have a little bit of grit. You know, I think that's really what it is. I have a little bit of grit and a little bit of passion, and then that keeps me over there. And So yeah, so Greg invites me for an interview. I mean, I don't know anything about Greg Carr. Mm. During my time living in Mozambique, Gorongosa had been under some conflict situation. So nationals, U.S. nationals weren't permitted travel. So I had no idea about the story. I never looked it up. And then I come here to Boise to do an interview. And then I get picked up by the airport by some random person and taken to the HP, so Hewlett Packard headquarters here in Boise. Yeah. And then Greg jumps in and he's talking with people and they're like, oh, hi. You know, they sort of acknowledge my presence. And then we get to this HP thing and I'm fresh from Mozambique. You know, I'm still quite feral. You know, I've been living, I hadn't left Mozambique for years. You know, 2.5 years. I'd been there.
Yeah.
And so then I'm in this situation and now I'm in this huge conference room with all these very well-dressed and well-mannered HP employees and executives. And then, and I'm not sure what I'm doing there because I'm supposed to interview for this job. I'm all prepared. I got a haircut, you know, wore a suit. And just look ridiculous. And then Greg walks the front and he starts giving his talk. And he gives his 30-minute spiel, which is, you know, how he got involved, why he's so passionate about Mozambique, how Gorongosa National Park is going to be the greatest wildlife restoration story in the whole world, and how he's going to uplift 200,000 people and save the elephants and save the rainforest. And I'm walking it. I'm watching. I remember I got a bunch of I have such a sweet tooth. It's horrible. So I just had a plate full of all the sweet cakes and things they had. I was just eating them, watching this presentation. And I mean, honestly, nothing. There was no big shift in my mind. There was no big key turn. But that was literally a seed that was planted. And after that moment, I was hooked. He sold. I don't know who he was trying to convince. I don't know if HP ever gave us even a printer or whatever. But he sold it. He sold me on the whole story, and that was it. Like that day, you know. The next day, we woke up and we had a breakfast, and he just started giving me work. And pretty much that's been my relationship with Greg for the last 6 years. It's like wake up in the morning, I just have a bunch of stuff to do, and I wasn't even hired, and I started working, and then that was it. And I think I stayed in the States for another kind of week or two deliberating.
Yeah.
And then just organized my flight with them and showed up and, you know, was back. I was neck deep from day one with Gorongosa. And they have not taken their foot off the gas pedal for a single moment in the last 6 years. It's just been full on acceleration. How do you uplift 200,000 people and save a national park and create, you know, an area the size of Belgium that's going to be a biodiversity reservoir for the next 100 years? And those are the marching orders, you know, that big. And I think that's really what convinced me. And I didn't know how real it was. Like, obviously, I've never worked for something so visionary before. So, you know, every 6 months, every year, I'm always rechecking and calibrating and questioning, like, is this real? And every year it's like, yeah, this is as real as it gets. And this is about as big a story as you could ever be a part of.
It's a huge story. And I think you're damn right. It's massive. What fascinates me there's so much about the Gorongosa project that fascinates me, but the leadership of the program is incredible. Here we're talking to people that do not have conservation backgrounds. You're not technically Indeed. Biologists. You're not wardens. You're not immersed in that industry at all. You are individuals that come out of various walks of life, and you're now running this most incredible trend-setting, life-changing initiative, breaking the traditional conservation molds, the national park molds, and doing something completely new and invigorating that is achieving all the goals that it set out to achieve, from what I can see. So, yeah. you've interviewed with Greg. he's inspired you, he's planted his seeds, now he starts throwing water on that seed, it germinates, and what, you end up going over to Mozambique.
Yeah, and just to add to what you're saying, yeah, I myself am not a conservationist. So I've had to fake it and learn a lot along the way. And what's great is there are some pretty amazing conservationists working there. So me as a, yeah, again, my background was engineering, and then I had this community, I guess one could call it community development stint in northern Mozambique. Then I fly over there, and I hit the ground running with two major projects, really. Those first couple of years were two major projects, and one, and both were project development. One could call it project management and program management, which are a couple different things, but they're pretty similar. And they threw me in with something they were calling the biodiversity, like higher education biodiversity program, which didn't have a name, didn't really have a form. It was this, it was a concept and a proposition that we want to be part of training the next generation of Mozambicans to be conservation biologists, and to the country has about 17 protected areas, and so to run those protected areas. And this was all born from a deficiency in the curriculum around basically conservation biology, around understanding the ecology, understanding all the ologies, entomology, you know, ornithology, yeah, and then the principles of conservation. And so that was one hat that they said, okay, you're going to wear this. And then the second hat they said is, we're starting this coffee project on this mountain. And they said, it's sort of a war zone. It takes 3 hours on the worst road you've ever encountered in your life. And it's going to be, it's like, and like, we don't know what's happening and no one can go there. And like, you have to go with this Zimbabwean agronomist and you guys have to figure this out. And yeah, I just had very little rules. It was very much not about, there was no coloring in the lines with this. It was more about, you know, crafting the picture and then figuring out what that picture is. And I think that that's what really appealed to me, was the creative problem solving in with very high stakes. I would say that's what's kept me there, is high stakes problem solving. You know, that pretty much sums up my daily life.
Well, from what I've seen, my son's a recent graduate and is an engineer as well.
Oh, wow.
I've learned to understand that the discipline that he's studied in, be it material science, is okay. It's a great subject. But what it's taught him, the whole engineering field, has taught him the ability to think strategically and to think in an orderly fashion and problem solve. So clearly, this is where your background or your training comes in, your education comes in. But I just want to share some perspective, because like when you first went into Mozambique, you didn't really understand what the country was about. I'm sure many of our podcast listeners are probably diving onto the internet right now to do some research on Mozambique. It's not a very well publicized country, and for the long it's been regarded as the poorest country potentially in the world, but definitely on the continent of Africa. Was in the bloodiest of civil wars from the 70s into the 80s, and that civil war really came to a conclusion in the 90s, early 90s.
Yeah.
So one has to understand that this is the perspective that you guys are now moving into Mozambique.
Yeah.
Intellectual property is non-existent. I mean, there is no infrastructure, there is no electricity, there is no water. And now you're trying to tell people to protect their biodiversity when literally on a daily basis they're trying to find food to put in a bowl. That is the perspective. And when you say this enormous project, the enormity of what you guys have chosen to address, which is, there's just no parallel here really in North America that people can relate to, I don't think.
Mm. No, I totally agree. I think there's something that is a bit difficult to understand. What took me a while to understand is that there is poverty, and I understand poverty. You know, I've been to many countries, and myself, I come from, you know, very, very, very humble roots in LA, you know, where we lived on government assistance. You know, it's a real challenging upbringing, you know, that for an American standard, it was really tough. For any standard, I think it was a tough upbringing. And so I experienced poverty. What is going on in Mozambique, rural Mozambique particularly, because the cities could tell a different story, but, you know, 80% of the people live in rural places. Rural Mozambique is what's called extreme poverty, which is less than $2 a day, and it's different from poor people. Extremely poor people have very challenging conditions around, like you mentioned, Warren, enough food to eat, you know, basic things like that, healthcare to deliver their babies in a healthy way. You know, they're challenged with incredibly tough, you know, diseases. So you have these tropical diseases and infectious diseases, which are just like really battering some of these communities. And those conditions called extreme poverty are very different from poverty. Because in a lot of Africa, in my travels, you will see poor people. You'll see very, very rich people, but you'll also see, you know, a lot of poor people who are on their way to being in the middle class over time, you know? And that's the journey that most countries in the world take, is like they urbanize, they industrialize, they, you know, and it's not a perfect journey. And there's a lot of people that fall through the gaps. And I believe that is where special interventions like Gorongosa are needed, where Gorongosa Project, where you're addressing something that is system wide, and not only that, but it's causing, you know, like really, really challenging vulnerabilities for large communities. So we have, again, 200,000 people living around this park who are living in extreme poverty. I would say, you know, from our surveys, 80 to 90% of the people are living in these conditions, which is every year you're trying to scratch out enough food to feed your family and enough, you know, surplus to sell to buy soap and to buy very basic, you know, human needs, you know, like and pay a little bit of fees to send your kids to school or purchase a uniform or, you know, pay for a minibus to take you to a local clinic. Often people will just walk because they don't have the, you know, 5 cents to take it. So I think that's what's particularly interesting about Gorongosa, is that we've taken an approach which is we're going to be the greatest restoration project in the world, and at the same time we're going to do things world class. So we're going to have world class people working here. We're going to do world class science. We're going to do world class healthcare, world class education, and we're going to do it in in a war zone, and we're going to do it in extreme poverty. And no matter what happens, whether it's serious political conflict, whether it's economic collapse, whether it's cyclones that come out of nowhere and just crush everything around you, we're not going to leave. We're going to be in this for decades trying to fulfill this vision. I think that's a unique perspective, and I've seen amazing projects across Africa. We collaborate with everybody in this field, you know, Conservation International, Africa Parks, Peace Parks Foundation, a lot of, you know, Wildlife Conservation Society, and everybody else at every other scale in between. And there's few things that work in such difficult conditions, that work for such a long time, and that try to do both human development and conservation in an integrated way. I would challenge anybody to find something trying to do that at scale and in these type of conditions over the long term. It's incredible.
It's more than incredible. I mean, I actually run out of adjectives and superlatives to describe what it is that you're doing. I mean, and again, perspective is you've got 200,000 starving people that are looking inward at this restoration project that does have some wildlife and game in it, and obviously not a lot, but they see that as their food basket. and perhaps have been poachers, bushmeat poachers, rather than commercial poachers, seeing this as an opportunity to supplement their meager diets of whatever they've been able to scrape together on the ground and milk from their goats and cows. So for them, it's the grocery store. And then you get these administrators that come in and say, well, you know what, we're closing your grocery store. You no longer have access to it. And we're actually going to make it a sacrosanct place where you will ultimately in the long term benefit from. Stay with us, stick with us. We'll show you how to get there. I mean, that ambition is monumental.
Yeah.
But I think fundamental, I mean, the recognition of long-term view of that park and the park itself becoming this forever giving pie that those people will benefit from down the line is massive. For not only somebody to conceive of that idea, but to be able to convince the community that this is the vision and that they should share in it is remarkable too. I mean, how do you achieve that when you've got so many hungry
That's
people.
Interesting. Let me paint a slightly different picture and introduce a couple more actors into the play you've mentioned there. So yes, there are 200,000 people, and 80% are living in this extreme poverty. And yes, there is this national park that lives there. When we started, remember that the park had almost no animals. So it had been totally cleaned out. And this is where it's interesting, because the cleaning out does not happen from the community. The cleaning out happens from, this is the other person I want to introduce in there, is like the agent of, lawlessness. So you get the same people who are tracking elephants, killing elephants and doing these other things. Those are drug traffickers. Those are human traffickers, and they're wildlife traffickers. So I would say that they're an agent that that needs to be introduced into this story, because really it's not so much about the park and the people kind of trying to figure out a zero-sum game. It's like the park and the people both being vulnerable to this condition of lawlessness and this condition of the other pieces that such poverty kind of breeds, which is like they're also subject to these. And then you add into that the climactic shocks to the system. And all of a sudden, it's like, it's not so much about, and this is really what I think is exciting about doing conservation and human development at the same time, is instead of thinking about it as a zero-sum game, and the art of war or whatever, we start to think about it as like a win more scenario, where guess what? The national park can be an engine for economic development. And guess what? We can, the people working in the buffer zone, living around the park, we call it the buffer zone, people living around the park, they can be agents of, change in this ecosystem and in this economy, that, we can create a green economy together where the park is thriving. And so we've gone from, and we're doing this, we've gone from 2006, when they did the first surveys, there was 10,000 large animals across a, 400,000 hectare area, which is, I guess that's almost 1 million acres. It's a huge area. And basically all animals had been cleaned out. 10 years later, that number is at 100,000 large animals. And those are just the ones you count from a helicopter. It's a tenfold increase over 10 years. That's 10,000 large animals to 100,000 large animals, and that's an incredible. That's the ecosystem bouncing back rapidly within 10 years. It's, that's adding 10,000 large animals a year. I mean, that's incredible. It's an incredible number to kind of conceptualize. And that's because the habitat is there, and because, everyone's working together. So I think that's the exciting thing about Gorongosa, is it's this mutually beneficial relationship where you have a park which is driving, is becoming this engine for creating livelihoods that are more dignified, more resilient, more inclusive than, say, the livelihoods created in the conditions of extreme poverty where you're just trying to survive. And all of a sudden, those livelihood opportunities start to pervade the entire area around the park and within the park, thinking of ecotourism, thinking of park operations, thinking of the amazing 300, rangers that are running around the park. And think about this. We've hired the first ever women rangers in Mozambique. So, and I at this point, I'm not trying to brag. It's more like I'm myself marveling at some of the things that are being done in Mozambique because of the conditions in which we're operating, if that makes sense. It's like it is a marvel, and to me, even myself, I'm often it's often like such an amazing thing and a privilege to be a part of.
I know that it one just wonders, what the exponential growth ultimately is going to be. I mean, if you take zero and you add one, you've grown that by 100% already, and that's kind of where.
Yeah.
And if I look at Gorongosa and where it is at today, and that's the one, it's truly a remarkable stride. So where does it go? Does it end? I mean, I don't believe it does end. You expand and expand. I know you mentioned the coffee up on the mountain. And again, this was part of the conversation that I had with both Test and Larissa, is this sort of paradigm shift away from the national park status being sacrosanct, keep man out, keep wildlife within. You're now attracting some form of agricultural practice into an area of the park, right? Which is an unusual.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting perspective, and that I've sat across the table from conservation professionals over the last few years, and we've had this discussion, and we've been we've been very candid about the approach. The first thing I would call the coffee project is a reforestation project. So it's a livelihoods project. It's a reforestation project. It's trying to create green jobs. Mm-hmm. And I think that in the early days, so slightly before my time, they came in with the idea, some very well-meaning people who I believe didn't really understand the conditions of rural Mozambican people, where they said, why don't we all volunteer to quit cutting down trees and start planting trees? And they sang songs, and they carried trees into the forest. And it lasted a very short time, because guess what happens when you try to eat a tree? doesn't do nothing. And so people have to have livelihoods, and their livelihoods depend right now. That livelihood, this is what's exciting about coffee, is at the moment, the conditions are, cut down a rainforest, plant some maize, and then you get a couple of years out of the soil until you've exhausted the nutrients. Now you're moving to the next area, and that model really, it never, even at its best, because I have no judgment about somebody's livelihood. My dad was an iron worker. I washed dishes. My mom cleaned, stalls for horses. Like, there's nothing wrong with doing what you got to do to get by. The challenge with that particular livelihood is it never reduces your vulnerability. You never get out of being, of being subject to the rain coming, of being subject to commodity prices falling, of plagues, literally. Plagues, yeah. You see, everyone's watching in Kenya, a biblical plague happening, or whatever else comes your way. And so, I really respect the autonomy and sovereignty of, these communities to do what it is they want to do and need to do to survive and thrive. And, and they themselves are also looking for opportunities. So when we came in with coffee, what's exciting is the lead of the project was the current park warden, Pedro Maguda, who's a lifelong forester. He literally has planted more trees in Mozambique than any human being. He's planted I'm quite literally a million or more trees. There's no exaggeration. The guy has just been a passionate longtime tree planter.
And to illustrate his passion, one's got to also understand that he's not using mechanized means of planting trees. Right. He's digging holes by hand and literally watering them with watering cans, right?
Right. That's exactly right. And now, you know, he's gone from forest educator to head of conservation to now the park warden. So he teamed up with a world-class Zimbabwean agronomist named Quentin Haroff, who ran the biggest coffee project in Zambia, 3,000 hectares, huge, massive operation. And Quentin's taken this on as a passion project with Pedro, and they start going to the community talking to them about coffee. And all of a sudden, the paradigm shifts because these farmers, they're one, living in national parks. So we're trying to figure out what is a sustainable livelihood that one can do in this park that brings back the forest. And coffee has been done, as people are doing this in you know, all over the world. They're doing this in Indonesia. They're doing this in South America. They're doing this, you know, all over the world. People are using coffee as a mechanism for reforestation. And that's exactly the approach we took. So it's,
can I pause you there just for a second? I'm sort of trying to comprehend how coffee is the catalyst for reforestation, because we're not talking about a forest of coffee. We're talking about forest as an agricultural practice. I mean, coffee as an agricultural practice. How is that going to attract back the indigenous forest that once occurred on the slopes of Gorongosa?
That's fantastic. I would say it does it in a bunch of ways, but here's my simple version of it, is that what we're growing is a particular type of coffee. It's called shade-grown coffee. So coffee is a rainforest plant. Coffee was born, you know, in the rainforest. It loves a rainforest condition. So what we're creating is a rainforest. And underneath that rainforest is coffee. And so what that does in an exciting proof of concept, and I don't know, Warren, if you got a chance, I don't think you've got a chance to see yet the coffee project. So this will be your 2021 mission. We're optimists, so we're saying the world becomes more mobile in 2021, and you get over to Mozambique.
Yes, please.
So you come up to Mount Gorongosa, and what you'll see is you'll see large areas of completely barren land with little green shrubs, and lots of trees planted, you know, small little seedlings planted near those shrubs. And what that is called the year one of coffee. It's just, you know, it was a totally denuded hillside, you know, not a single tree, you know. And then we've gone in with the community, we planted coffee with them, and we planted native hardwood trees. And that sits there. And now you look to your right. So you've looked from this kind of bare hillside with all these little green shrubs, and you look to the right, and you see a forest. Unless you're like a PhD ecologist, I call it a forest. So you call it a forest. And it's a forest. It's like a full closed canopy forest. And you're like, okay, that's a forest, and that's a barren hillside with a bunch of shrubs. And I would say that barren hillside, they call that year one coffee. That forest, that's year five coffee.
Oh, wow.
And this has been, I've been there for 6 years. I literally have seen it. And I'm not an agronomist, you know, so everything I've learned in the field. And I've been amazed at the ability for this mountain to heal itself, to become a forest again, to go from totally, you know, barren hillside to closed canopy forest in 5 years. And it's there. And the question, the most important question for us might be this, and you could ask this question. Well, you have a forest, but, you know, you have what looks like a forest, but does it have biodiversity? Mm-hmm. You know, does it have the thing that we're trying to protect? You know, does it have biodiversity? And what we're doing is we've set, you know, Gorongosa is a huge experiment. Like, what happens when you go from no animals to bringing back the animals? Like, what happens to the ecosystem? Because that's the story of the future, which is, and that's just my like humble opinion, is that we're going to be rewilding large areas. Okay, so we've developed them, populations then shrink, and then those areas have to come back to life because we need those ecosystem services to keep our planet like alive, you know. And that there's nothing tree hugger about that, you know. That's like that's human being, you know. You need ecosystem services to pollinate your crops, to, you know, filter your water. It's like, you know, I know that from a, you know, engineering standpoint. You just, you have to have those systems functioning. And so the question is, does the biodiversity function on this mountain? And all of our research is saying, yes, we're getting, you know, in a coffee agroforest system like we have, you get up to 80% restored biodiversity. And so here's the play, Warren. Here's the big gamble. We have to get peace, which we're very close. They signed the peace treaty last year, and they signed it in Gorongosa. It was so exciting.
Wow.
And then our challenge is this. Yes, we do want to have a rainforest without coffee. At that same time, we want to attract the people who have been forced to live deep in the rainforest. They don't want to live there because you talk to them, they're like, yes, we want schools and clinics, and we want access to these things. We want to come out of the forest. So they come down out of the forest, and they create this band of coffee all around this cap of rainforest. And that band serves as a, you know, long-term livelihood. Like, and you and me, when we walk through there, you'd be hard-pressed to really see a big difference between that forest and what you're seeing deep in the forest. And yeah, there's you'll see coffee, but it really is a reforestation project and a livelihoods project, first and foremost. I think agriculture, you know, wouldn't be, because we do agriculture down outside the mountain, outside of the park. We work with 10,000 farmers to bring to do agricultural interventions, and that's everything from maize to the big one is cashew and honey. Those are a big, like, you know, it's a big position. But on Mount Gorongosa, it's a reforestation project, and if you're, you know, if you're not pragmatic enough to realize that, you know, people need livelihoods, then, you know, then it's going to be a tough world to navigate, because you have to make a lot of pragmatic decisions when you're working in rural conditions.
Yeah, I'm wrapping my head around everything that you've said there, because you've pumped a lot of information out at me and people who are listening in. And I'm just thinking about my knowledge of the history of Mozambique, and particularly the traumatic images that I've seen Chinese industrialists coming in there with their harvesting machines and literally tearing out the rainforests on a whole scale basis. I mean, Mozambique used to be home to some of the richest rainforests in the world, beautiful teak trees, ebony trees, and others that have been denuded. And I suppose if the approach had been one of a more sustainable approach, it could have left the country partially in good forestry health, but it didn't. And I just think that the age of these forests and how much longer they can sustain our cruel harvesting. And this is project on its own. I mean, you think of Gorongosa. I think of Gorongosa as a wildlife biome and a place where, you know, a free roaming natural ecosystem exists. I never really thought of Mount Gorongosa and the whole reforestation aspect of it, which I suppose is fundamental. I mean, that's a hugely sacred mountain and of massive significance in the communities that live around it.
And you know, it's not unique in the challenges we're facing. You know, if you go to Niassa, where I lived, and I've been back there to help work with the Wildlife Conservation Society and the government of Mozambique on a management plan for an area that is really big. You know, the Niassa Reserve is one of the biggest contiguous Miombo woodlands in the world, and it's just massive. And they face most of the challenges we face, and then some. So. So the challenges aren't so unique. I think, what's exciting is that, you know, we've managed to find that balance of how do you uplift people and conserve the biodiversity and restore it, you know, and think long term. You know, we could be doing this coffee for the next 50 years, you know, and that's generational. They could, you know, these families could, you know, their children could, at first they could send all their kids to school with the money they make from coffee, which they wouldn't stand a chance to do that with their, with some of these other livelihoods that are available. And then after that, the kids could, they could run these farms if they're interested, or they could, you know, live in town and they could hire somebody to, like, I mean, that's what they do in so many countries, is like somebody might own a farm and they'll hire people, or they might aggregate and you'll get cooperatives. And I think it's going to be a beautiful evolution to how this project rolls out. It's by no means defined. The story is by no means written. And the you know, the writers of this story are the people of Mozambique. There are a few of us who, you know, have a hand in crafting this message and have a hand in facilitating that process. But it's, you know, they're an incredible, my experience, you know, I have, like, under my little department, there's 90 of us. So, you know, sure. I have those pretty deep connections with most of those folks. And then we work with 10,000 people. And, you know, I've personally known many of the farmers and all these things, you know, they're agents in this story. And I think what's even, to me, even more fascinating to that is, guess who else is an agent in this story? Their ancestors and their spiritual connection and their spiritual beliefs. And I think that, you know, having sat through dozens of these, you know, spiritual ceremonies with my colleagues and my friends and, you know, these farmers I work with, you know, we take it very seriously, the ancestor as a stakeholder. And we, you know, if you don't, I promise you are in for some trouble. I can tell you some very funny stories of accidentally forgetting to do a ceremony and then seeing all your best laid plans go to ruin. So that
is interesting, because how do you bring ancestors, history, the past tenants into play?
Yeah.
How do you do that? What is the
that's a super good question. And so the important part to remember about me and my role is, like, I have a specific role in this team that we have, and in the orchestra that we're trying to do here. You know, there's many of us. We all have agency in this process. So the key is the leadership and the consensus building that goes on within the communities and within the Gorongosa project. And like, we don't make a move that isn't fully accepted, vetted, you know, bought into and planned with government agencies, with local leaders, with tribal leaders, with, and then, you know, sometimes they'll say, oh, this guy's the leader. But once you're deep in there, you've been there for 5 years, you know that there's this other group of folks who are really the leader of this little village, you know. And so having that type of intimate knowledge of communities and then really making space for them as sovereign actors and agents in this, you know, in this journey, in the story. And then, you know, honoring that and respecting that through, you know, for me, I'm a project, you know, I'm an organized thinker. So I'm like, oh yeah, we have to plan for this in our work plan. Yeah, you have ceremonies. It's part of the process. You pray to the ancestors and you do this thing, because if you don't, you've kind of neglected something that's really important in this process. And I think that's, you know, that's just part of how we operate intrinsically. You know, it's part of our DNA in Mozambique, is like, in Gorongosa project, is, you know, everyone there also has spiritual beliefs. You know, my colleagues and peers and managers and supervisors, they also have, you know, share many of these beliefs. So we have we have it in our mandate to really honor that. And I think it's been an interesting, I could just tell you that, I'll just tell you a very short story if I can, Warren. I think we're okay. We're at an hour, but I'm happy to keep going.
This is interesting, Matt.
So in the early days, you know, I'm quite green behind the ears, you know, I'm still figuring stuff out on the coffee project and really trying to do my part and putting in a lot of hours and whatever. And I am a very data-driven person, and many of my colleagues, my Mozambique colleagues, are also very data-driven. And we all decided to put a very small weather station, you know, this kind of fancy weather station that gives us mobile data. It was the coolest thing to have on the mountain where you're trying to, you need rainfall every, you know, every month to make it work. And right. So we put this weather station up. You know, you can picture what it looks like. It's a little kind of boxy thing with a little weather thing that spins, you know, a wind vane or whatever. And okay, yeah. So that, I mean, you know, it looks like a little simple little weather station. It's not very big. You know, you can hold it in your hands. And it was up there for a couple of weeks. I had just put it up there in this little plot, coffee plot that we have. And it was part of this, it was like 2015, 16, which was like, or 16, 17. It was one of the greatest droughts in sub-Saharan African history that was kind of bearing down on everybody. It was like an El Nino year or something. It was really, I mean, it was like forecasts were pretty severe and we just weren't getting rain and everyone's freaking out and people, you know, are starting to lose crops. And these are serious things and they happen all the time in Mozambique, you know, in these rural areas. And everyone's paying attention, you know, and then we get this message. Our lead supervisor calls me, goes, they tell me that we've got to take the weather station down. And at first I'm like, what? I'm like, did I understand? Like, why? And they're like, well, they think that little spinny thing is keeping the rain away from the mountain. And it's creating bad spirits. And I'm like, are you crazy? What are we talking about? This is insane. And I have a little meeting, you know, I have a little, cause they said they're going to burn it. They're like, tomorrow we will burn it. And I was like, wait, please. And then we meet and everyone talks and we make the decision. You know, I'm outvoted and we make the decision to take the weather station down, you know,
yeah.
It comes down. And the next day it just rains like hell. It just rains like a torrential downpour, you know, like the skies open up and you know, flooding of biblical proportion happens, and there's these smug dudes on the mountain that when every time they see me they just kind of like look at me with this smug expression on their face, and I just have to like put my head down and just understand that that I don't always, you know, that sometimes you just have to like go roll with the punches, and that's you know, that's the learning that's here, is that you really respect people's agency and you respect the agency of something that might not be articulated. And I work with very hardcore scientists, like evolutionary biologists, who themselves have to sit. I mean, they get incest. It's beautiful to watch. You know, nothing is better than watching, you know, an atheist evolutionary biologist who's read, you know, Stephen Hawking and Darwin and everybody else have to sit and pray in these ceremonies because they want to access some of these wild areas to do biodiversity research. I find it to be the most.
I hope you took your little weather box back to those guys and showed it to them the week after Idai had passed over.
Yes, sir. We. You know, and that's the thing, is that when you do the process right, we went up there, we had a ceremony, everyone was involved, it was, and everything's fine, you know, and now it works and no one questions it. And so once you're into the cultural system that exists, you've managed to make some progress. And so, it's not rocket science, but it's cultural science, and it's not by any means obvious. There's so much below the surface that that is guesswork, even for the most intimately knowledgeable of their culture. So, like, you know, we hire people from the mountain. There are, you know, what we're calling these community based agents that work there and really facilitate the technical agronomists, who are also all Mozambican, with the very rural farmers who live in the mountain. And so they provide this bridge. And for them, and this is people from live there. A lot of the cultural stuff is guesswork also. You know, there's no right answers to a lot of this stuff. It's gray areas, and it's respect, and it's best practices, and it's cultural intuition, which these guys have in spades. So, I mean, for me as a project manager, I'm always thinking of like how best to leverage those things to help every, you know, to create a win more situation where everyone's benefiting. You know, it's sort of like this. If a doctor comes to your house, Warren, and I don't know how healthy you are. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you eat salads every day and run, you know, run for an hour, whatever you're supposed to do. Let's assume that you're like every human being on earth and you don't do all the right things for you. Maybe you forget to floss and maybe do these things, even though you know in your head that you should do these things. Well, I think that helping, you know, in the case of you, like finding out what works in your life and to help you yourself do behavior change is the exact principle that we apply, you know, in the work we're doing with behavior change. You know, there's no difference between the human mind and the way we process things, you know, here in the United States, here in Boise, to the people I'm working with in very rural Mozambique. You know, the mind works very similarly. It gets nudged and it has, you know, biases and, you know, heuristic metrics and all these things that are part of how the human mind works. And I think we've done a good job of being patient and understanding some of those things and just being part of a behavior change story where everyone is saying, well, we know that, for example, that this livelihood will actually be better for us, but we can't just jump in head first because we're human beings. Mm-hmm. We have to be part of a long-term process where, you know, we start from X and, you know, A, and we end up in B, and we go all zigzaggy in between. So, and our jobs really as change agents is facilitating that process. You know, we're not doing much more than presenting a vision and facilitating a process.
Yeah, quite right. And with the right intellectual backing behind you to do it as well as financial. I was just pondering the enormity of the economy that you're creating there. And, you know, with all the seed planting that's going on, there's got to be a period of time where it takes, you know, the seed to germinate and eventually bear fruit, mm-hmm. thinking of the 1 to 5 year plan with the coffee. And how does this all get financed? You know, now there's no significant tourism into that area. So that's not a major generator just yet. I'm sure it's going to become one, and certainly within the next decade. But how do you, I mean, I'm just thinking of the people and convincing them of this hope that they're planting in the ground, this commerce that's going to come their way. What tides them over between now and then? And how does one finance such a massive project?
Yeah, you've asked, I think, a question that we get asked a lot, especially from people who want to replicate the model. So it's a super astute question that you've asked. Is you've realized that the timings are a little bit there's a little bit of a time lag between plant coffee and you benefit from coffee. And so on that specific front, I'll just mention that and then I'll just say one thing about financing. But on the farmer program, there we do a lot of thinking about risks and rewards to farmers. So we want to make sure we have a shared risk and inclusive, you know, model that we're working with, so that no one gets left out, especially, you know, women heads of household, which are often excluded from many of these programs just naturally, mm-hmm. from the cultural biases that might exist. And so what we do is we create this this journey. So it's like a farmer journey where they come in with us and they start right away with a lot of training. So there's all these trainings that they can participate in, which are really exciting. A lot of them are zero cost practices, which things like planting in line, getting the right information about when exactly to plant. And they do have a lot of historic information, but even with that, having access to more information is power. You know, information is power. And so when we provide more information, they're able to make more informed decisions about how to plant and do things like that. So the training component is huge. And part of that is also very much not related to agronomy, very much related to farming as a business. And I think that that's fundamental. Farming is their livelihood. It's their life and it's their livelihood. And the surplus money they make off of farming is what they use to, you know, pay for everything they get in the world. And so what we're trying to do is help conceptualize that as a bit of, you know, a micro business, a small business. And we're finding that people really respond well to this. We call it Farmer Business School. It's a program that's being done all across Africa. It's fantastic for facilitating the journey from a subsistence farmer into a small scale commercial farmer, which is only by definition. But as soon as you start thinking about things commercially and you start to, you know, think about expanding a little bit, or you think about getting more yields and these other things, they allow you to have a lot more agency and to reduce your vulnerability, which is like the big key here. It's like we want to help facilitate resilient communities that aren't falling apart every time there's a crazy cyclone or some commodity thing. So we provide in these early stages, these startup stages, we help to provide inter-row crops. So that's maize, that's beans, and that's crop rotation. So you learn all these really great best practices while you're getting some uplift to your household, you know, food budget and your household surplus, which is fantastic. And meanwhile, so those are the main ways we do it. We do it also with cashew, because cashew is about the same, where it's about 5 years. So it's like you get cashew seedlings, you plant them out, and in between the cashew rows, and same with the coffee, you're planting maize under one line, and then you're planting beans under the other line. Next year, you're crop rotating those. And that's a pretty big incentive, you know, to be involved with that. Now, take that package, and that's the package that is part of under my, like with my team, we're heavily involved with that. And now you add the integrated approach of Gorongosa, which means that farmer, now their kid is being engaged with our education team. And now their, you know, their wife becomes some part of a model mom program. And their other product that they're growing, which is often sesame or some other thing, like for example, this last year they did yellow maize as a commercial product. We're finding markets and linking them with markets. So all of a sudden, it becomes a really holistic approach to some of this. And then over time, they're already building up the architecture for a more to get out of extreme poverty. That's the whole thing. It's like you cannot get out of extreme poverty unless you have access to markets, access to finance, education, healthcare, all these simple basic principles. And we start to just build that up over time. And by the time your coffee and cashew start to kick in and produce some serious economic benefit, you know, you've been through a couple years of training. You know, you've connected some new markets. You know, your kids are in school for the first time or whatever. And all of a sudden you're ready to just transition out of this super vulnerable state into a more resilient state.
Yeah, you know, it's just struck me what you're doing. You're rebuilding civilization.
We're just reinforcing it. You know, it's you're going from being incredibly vulnerable to all of the shocks. And guess what, world? Like, you and I are sitting, you know, we're in COVID now. In Mozambique, we've had COVIDs every 8 months. You know, we've had something of equivalent magnitude in terms of impact on livelihoods every 8 months. So for us, COVID is just another in a long string of shocks. And, you know, my personal opinion is the world is becoming, in an ironic twist, you know, people often talk about how they want to develop, you know, Mozambique or whatever. We talk about it a lot. And it's true. We want to develop it to become more resilient and be more like so much more of the developed world where people have livelihoods, you know, sustainable livelihoods. At the same time, the shocks, the climate shocks, all these things that have been happening in these rural communities, guess what? Those are coming for the rest of the world. You know, climate shocks, economic shocks, you know, pandemics, you know, infectious diseases. Those are things we've been dealing with for the last, you know, I personally been dealing with for the last 6 years with these folks. So, yeah.
Funny observation there, but you're quite right. I think we as the Western world have been, to a large degree, looking in the wrong places for many of our answers. And assimilating everything that you've been talking about in terms of developing this resilience over there, it seems to me that you are actually really fortunate to be able to work with a raw material that has that resilience inherently built into it. I mean, when we started out this podcast, the first thing you spoke about was the amazing strength that those people in that community had, both to survive and the hard lifestyles that they were living. So here I'm thinking that this basic commodity that you're working with to develop Gorongosa is this incredibly powerful and strong community that are resilient to the storms that weather them on a monthly basis,
yes, sir.
Monthly basis. And with that, you can achieve exactly what you are achieving. It's quite, for me, it's quite a, I don't know, that the whole thing has just become so distilled and clear in my mind.
Yeah. I'd like to just maybe end with the one note about which ties into what you asked about. How does the whole thing happen? And the whole thing happens through very human-centric relationships and partnerships. So there's a lot of people in this world who believe in what we're doing. And that's, you know, from the United Nations Development Program to the Global Environmental Facility to specific countries like Ireland, who in a very fascinating way identify intimately with the story of Gorongosa in Mozambique. So, you know, Ireland was a colony for, I don't know, 600 years, you know, mm-hmm. and they had civil war, you know, and they've overcome that, and they've had an economy that crashed and they overcame all that. So when an Irish person, and we work very closely with the Irish government and the Irish people in a lot of our, you know, developing stuff, and they're supporters of ours, they come at this with a very unique perspective of being like, oh yeah, guess what, Mozambique, we've been through this. And there is light at the end of the tunnel, you know. So we have partnerships like that. We work with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, who funds a lot of the science education, Oak Foundation, United States Agency for International Development. I'm literally just paying my taxes. And I'll tell you, it's not very exciting to have a huge tax bill to like pay. But I know that a small percentage of that tax money, as an American taxpayer, I'm also supporting the work we're doing in through USAID in Mozambique. They're one of our biggest supporters, you know, and they truly believe in our mission, and they use us as a model in their global outreach that they do around the world. So, you know, and that's just one of many partners. The government of Mozambique, the Ministry of, well, now the Ministry of Change a little bit, but the Ministry of Agriculture, Ministry of Tourism, the local leaders. Like, we have, there's an amazing person who's just, his story is so amazing. He's the mayor of Vila Gorongosa, where we have our coffee factory and where we have our cashew. And he was a farmer, you know, like a no-shoes farmer. And he worked himself up, you know. He now is a successful, you know, self-made man. You know, quite literally a self-made man. And he, I have an email in my inbox from him saying, "I want to make, you know, Vila a model city. I want to make this a model city for the world. I want to, you know, we've talked about planting this year. We planted, you know, a few thousand trees in his city, and he's super excited about it. He wants to see the urban development, which is inevitable. You know, every country in the world." Every country in the world urbanizes. It's just part of human nature. He wants to see that urbanization be inclusive, be dignified, be resilient. And that's a mayor of this village that, you know, and that's actually where my home is in Mozambique. Wow. Is this tiny village. So it's pretty exciting, I think, to think about the partnerships. And that's where the funding comes from. The funding comes from a bunch of partners, global partners, who believe in this. And the way it's executed is local partnership, you know, with people who have agency, who have sovereignty, and who are committing themselves to the same development vision that we're committing ourselves to. So it's a pretty fascinating thing. And I think that's been, if you could say there's been one interesting success in Mozambique or in Gorongosa Project, it's the fact that we've gotten everybody to see the same vision. You know, we've got from the very, you know, local, you know, they're called local leaders, all the way up to the president of the Republic of Mozambique, to international partners. They're all lockstep in thinking that this can be a model for how conservation is done and how human development is done in Mozambique.
That is so very true. And, you know, Matt, I feel as though we've just scratched at so many little surfaces in the tapestry of the Gorongosa project. I feel utterly privileged to be able to share some of the story. And I look forward to, I mean, I'd love to interview that mayor. I'd love to interview people on the ground and hear how they feel about the project, because it is one that is, it's, I mean, anybody who doesn't find it inspiring has got to be somewhat brain dead.
Yeah, indeed.
The one thing that you have referred to throughout, in fact, right in the beginning, when you had your meeting at the Hewlett-Packard boardroom, was the seed was planted. And it seems to me that this has been the theme of Gorongosa from its inception, is a series of seed planting in a variety of forms, nurturing them along the way, providing some fertilizer, and then watching things grow, reaping the harvest and reinvesting. Yeah. It's fascinating. I'm so pleased that we've had this hour and a half to chat. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks. And I would say my last absolutely shameless plug is to, check us out, Gorongosa Coffee, you know, gorongosacoffee.com. Get some coffee and be part of the story. Be part of this amazing story. Cool. Okay, buddy. Thanks so much, Warren.
Pleasure, Matt. It's been great chatting to you. Thanks.
Take care.
Okay. Bye.